Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. I for sure am, for sure, tonight. No ads, no opening. I'm going to go right to it. I posted, I haven't done Adam's Rampage in a while. I haven't gone off, if you will, and done my little rants, etc. But we are broadcasting live on Facebook as well. On my personal page, it's private. So if you're not friends, no one else can see this. You know what I mean? The Tribe of Change, welcome everybody. I love every one of you. I say it all the time, but I love you all, Tribe. Thanks for bearing with me, everybody. Now, if you bought the first edition of the book, then you may know some of this story. You may know about the principles of change that I'm going to talk about. But I thought it relevant to, I don't know, share some of my background story a little bit on how this all came to fruition a little bit. So over the next couple days or whatever, weeks or so, whenever, I'm going to walk through my book with you. I'm going to walk through some, I don't know, the surface areas, if you will, of the book, right? And I'm going to walk you through the beginning. So if you bought the first book, you know the first chapter is The Human Behind the Rampage. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about The Human Behind the Rampage. Some of you that are watching now live on Facebook, I may have grown up with, I may have spent a lot of my life with. And those of you listening to the podcast, maybe for the first time, may be saying, who is this ghetto motherfucker? I get it. I do. I've been getting it since I was a kid. I promise you. I've been getting it since I was a kid. And any of you watching that I went to school with, you know. You know. Your boy's been this way for a long time. But the appearance of what my life looked like in high school and what the reality was were two different pictures. And then the life that I created beyond that was, well, my creation. So when you heard that song from Haystack, So What? It opens up with, I know you're feeling about depression and anxiety, and they tell you about it, but after so long, you start to believe that. Well, that's kind of an opening. When you hear him talking about, man, I'm 30-something. I was supposed to been done be a murder victim. You see, the life that I portrayed in high school, what it looked like, is not what the storm was like inside. You know, it looked like the All-American kid. I played linebacker in high school, right? I was even quarterback in ninth grade. So it painted this picture. And what I kept quiet was the abuse that was in my home. Whether it was verbal, physical, it didn't matter. But my mother endured 26 years of, well, hell. Sure, it can be worse for other people and it's been worse for others. But for those that live your life in that moment, well, that's your hell. That's your perception. Ghetto's in the mind frame is what I like to say. So no one's ghetto is worse than another's because what you experience is your ride. So I kept hidden through high school what I experienced every night almost when I went home. Now, there were good times, don't get me wrong. There were things that my father provided that many fathers never did, and I'm grateful for those things for sure. I don't want to make it sound like I lived some fucking terrible life as compared to someone else's, but this was my ghetto. This was my place. Being called I'm going to use the nigger word, being called that by my own father multiple times. This happened day in and day out, physical abuse, watching my mother run out the door and hide in half-built homes in another subdivision. And this was my life day in and day out, wondering if that hall light was going to click on if I had not gotten up on time in the morning. I used to lay in that back bedroom. See, I committed to a dream that my father walked with me, which was to play professional football. Almost, what, 9 years old, 10 years old, he walks me out and says, son, if this is what you want to do, I can get you there. Very deep and connected. We shared long workouts and weightlifting and sweat and tears. But for the most part, it was hell for me. You see, I had to be on my feet at 5 a.m., 6th through 8th grade. I had to make sure I ate enough calories that morning before I went to school. And if I didn't, well, yeah. Sometimes I would eat and then I would have to go to the restroom and I would puke it all up. And sometimes he would know and I have to make a shake or I'd have to make something else to supplement that protein. See, my mornings consisted for those 3 years of wondering if my mother even went to sleep because I'd heard them yelling all night and things breaking and punching and screaming. Or if maybe that hall light would come on and I wasn't up at 5 a.m. like I was supposed to be, even though I didn't have to be at school till 9. You see, I still have nightmares sometimes when hall lights come on and, well, it bothers me. It takes me back to that place, you know, that scary place. So I hid it well. I hid behind arrogance. I hid behind a confidence that truly was a real insecurity. I had to fake it until I make it, if you will. I had to act as if, even though I knew it wasn't. See, my home was not a safe place, and if I could be anywhere else other than there, I chose to be. Miss Sloniker was a wonderful high school drama teacher that let me stay at her house one night when I had ran away. So my life consisted of violence day in and day out, yeah? It made me who I am today, so I don't hate on it. I don't regret it. And I'm grateful for even the fact that I had a father, at least now that I'm a father, that I have a litmus test, if you will, to compare it to say, okay, what would he do? What am I programmed to do? So stop and pause for a moment and do the opposite. There's many people out there that don't even have that. They have no identity of what a father is or is supposed to be or even mothers. And so they can't even correlate to what they're supposed to do or what they're not supposed to do. You see, as high school went on, in junior year, my mother finally got brave enough to leave. I hoped it was coming, but she would tell you the story that she finally decided to leave in my summer junior year when she saw me in the front yard as my father was on another tirade, yelling at her, screaming, being aggressive. Now, mind you, he's a large man, intimidating man. And he approached my mother almost physically, and my mother noticed that I balled my fist up and I stepped forward. Well, she knew then that, well, she had to go, or something bad was going to happen. So in a random morning, my mother was frantically packing her two-door Ford Taurus with what she could fit as she took off. And all I remember telling her in the garage was, go, mama, get out of here. I'll be fine. She was worried about me. And I said, go, mama, I'll be fine. Well, the next couple weeks as she stayed in hiding, we contacted each other through private phone numbers and special codes. And I stopped my father from committing suicide multiple times. As he ran for a 357 that for many years prior, I had attempted suicide more than one time. I wrote a paper on that 357 revolver Smith & Wesson later in college. But yeah, I found it ironic that it was the same gun that I was tackling my father from reaching before he could get to the drawer to finish what he said he was going to do. After weeks of enduring that, my brother finally came back up from the Keys because he had been kicked out much earlier and had quite a rough patch himself. And he joined us. I remember taking my father to see Saving Private Ryan. It was a terrible experience. I understand a little more about what that man was going through, what he felt inside. I'm not saying I agree, but I understand. He just couldn't handle it. And I watched him at one point, which I thought was a great man, disintegrate before my eyes pretty much my entire childhood as he took out his inability to chase his own dreams, to play the martyr for our family. So as I skipped out of his house at that time when I was 16 and went to live with my mother. We lived off Americana Boulevard, John Young Parkway, and a crossroad between Orange Blossom Trail. And those of you that have lived in Orlando, you understand where I'm talking about. And we lived in an apartment there. And my mother was beginning to rebuild her own life. I went to school, and I remember over that summer, we used to play, our football teams would get with other football teams and do pass skelly. No linemen, just the linebackers, etc. And we were scrimmaging a team, Osceola High School, which is known to produce some beasts. And there were a couple guys on that team that went Division I that played for the Orlando Predators and played pro. But see, I knew I was going home that night to a father who was going to discover that his wife of 26 years had finally left. And the last place I wanted to be was fucking home. So I tried to fight pretty much everybody on the Osceola football team and got a reputation of being a little out of my fucking mind. Because frankly, I'd rather get the shit kicked out of me or go to jail or do whatever I had to do than go home that night. But I went home that night. Over the next year or so, living with my mom, cars were stolen, threats were made, violence over the time. It was pretty bad. My father pretty much failed at being a man whatsoever and being able to spiritually attack whatever he felt was attacking him. And frankly, I lost any ounce of respect that remained for him whatsoever. Well, I went to college and I played football and I got injured and that ended. It wasn't the same for me in college, though. You see, in high school, when I played, I didn't have to think about what I was going home to until the game was over, because my worst critic most of my life was my father. See, when most of the guys would go eat at Denny's or somewhere after, I had to go home and watch film and listen to his favorite word to tell me that I look lethargic. But anyway, my big brother helped me find my way to college after an all-star game. And I played for Jacksonville University, and that injury pretty much was the end of me in college. Frankly, it wasn't the same, so I walked away and I turned to some serious gangster shit. You see, my mom was trying to build her own life, and she could manage a couple dollars that she could. Meanwhile, always looking over her shoulder and mine for all the promised threats that came from somebody. So, I didn't know what to do. So I committed my first alleged major crime, and I was off to the races. Things I struggled with for years, nightmares that stay with me. I started selling basically anything I could. Pills, drugs, you pick it. I was slanging it. Guns, hell, I was for hire. Robbing dope boys, doing without a mask, not giving a shit. Trying to commit suicide, but frankly, most of the people I was fucking with didn't know how to aim. So they missed a few times. I used to wish they didn't. After a while, I had lost some friends, some very close friends of mine, and went to prison for a long, long time. I faced a pretty hefty charge later after a couple misdemeanor arrests. We had gotten pretty organized, pretty big. We had made some lists that you don't really want to be on. Allegedly. By something miraculous, I managed to make it out of the dope game alive. And I took some of that money and I got into nightclubs and I met different friends. I was trying to change my life in some sort of different manner. But let me tell you, that nightclub business is just as dirty, if not dirtier, than the dope game. Did some more things that I regretted over that span. Made a lot of money, lost a lot of money. Partied like I was trying to die. See, the bullets didn't kill me in the dope game, so I was hoping maybe the drugs would. Maybe the heavy partying and non-sleep would eventually take its toll on me, but I never got so lucky. Somehow, though, I managed to stay in school just a little bit at a time. Because no matter what kind of shootout, how much dope I sold, or if the FBI was knocking on my door, it didn't matter because I had class on either Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday and Thursday. And I sat in those classes, and I felt normal, at least for 45 minutes at a time. You see, in that Haystack song, he talks about people judging other people. So when they hear me talk, or they used to hear me in high school or middle school talk the way I talk, trust me, there were choice words that were used to the type of person that I was described as. Well, I'm still talking like that today. You see, I ran into an old friend the other night, Chris Evelyn, man, and he pointed out, man, no way Adam came this far. No way that's the same guy that I know. See, we used to get drunk all the time and sit at a place called the Mountains. And I used to ride around, as he said, listening to Tupac smoking weed. And I said, hey, man, sometimes I still do that. Didn't let go of those things. See, I play that music before I get in here to remind me what I've been through, to be grateful for it. Let's just say some choice things happened and I made some changes. And in the book, I talk about one night I came home from the nightclub, one night of work. Everything was like normal. I rolled a blunt just like normal to calm it down. Next thing I know, I was sitting in the middle of my living room. Felt like I was dying. 16 hours. I call it my Lieutenant Dan moment. And if you've ever seen Forrest Gump, well, then you get it. I basically tied myself to the top of the sailboat and I said, God, give me what you got. For some of you, I know how it sounds, man. But for me, I had a lot of demons on me. I don't know what that night was, But I sat in that living room and I cried, I prayed, smiled, laughed. It was 16 hours of probably psychoness, but I don't know what you'd call it. I called it my spiritual rampage in the book, but I decided then I was done. Ended a relationship that was gone for a long time. It was rather wild. I cut all my friends off. I was about to launch a website at the time that me and my boy had been working on for a long time. Let go of my nightclub events, ownerships, nights, etc. Just let it all go. Gave most of my shit away and called my brother and I said, where are we going, man? Send me somewhere. What the fuck? I wound up on a Native American reservation for a little time. Wound up in the Keys digging holes, just trying to forget about velvet ropes and cocaine talk of what was going to unfold. I just wanted to get away from it all. That walk ended up being about 2 years, from Tennessee to West Palm Beach, from New Mexico to a few places. And my brother was always close in my heart. That's why he's tattooed on my arm. That's why he shares the same tattoo I do. You see, when I got to go to Tennessee, I would hang out with him and his family, and it's the closest thing to family I'd ever felt in my life. I felt that breakaway after I came back from this walkabout that I don't know, needed to question self, needed to fix self. See, a lot of people tell you that they get into psychology because they want to help people. That came later, but for me, I was just trying to save my fucking life. Well, I got into studying, research, etc. Finished a degree from Columbia. Immediately got enrolled into Nova's master's program for mental health counseling. I shit y'all not, man. I ain't made grades like that, but I made one fucking B, and that shit was controversial because I didn't study. I fucking trained. I trained like I was trying to save my own life. It was like 2 days of football practice for me, man. I read what they gave me, and I read more on top of that. I was trying to save my own fucking life. As I was approaching that, I end up falling in love with my daughter. Meeting her, I adopted her about 10 years old, got married, all of a sudden had a life I thought I was never worthy of. I fought for it. Now, I skipped a lot of small stories that maybe one day may be a movie or some documentary, man, that I like to title My Life as Brett Mercy. But I came out and then I got into mental health counseling. I graduated. They hired me before I even graduated. I'm not bragging, but I couldn't fucking believe it myself. I was sitting in addiction clinics working with some of the worst around the world, dealing with lifetimes of addiction. And then I saw corruption. I was devastated. I was devastated that the help that was being provided was fucking bullshit. It was linked to what I now call chemical incarceration. When I saw trading one drug for another, convincing people they had diseases, convincing people they had biological defects that they couldn't change and they needed to accept that, call themselves powerless and be just weak against changing their own life. And this is something I couldn't fucking stand for. I'd paid so much money for a fucking degree. And somehow, some spiritual something, I don't fucking know, call it what you want, led me to be introduced to Joe Rogan on a random, and this dude listened to my fucking story, and he brought my ghetto ass on his podcast, and I spit this shit out. And before you know it, I was fired from both of my therapist jobs in Orlando before I got back from LA after doing that podcast. I was basically blacklisted as a therapist, because finally, somebody had fucking said something. You see, there's 1,001 therapists out there that know exactly what the fuck I'm talking about. But you got to keep your lights on. You got to keep your job. You got to pay for your degree. You got to take care of your family. So I understand. I'm not saying I agree, but I understand. You see, you're not saying shit. And you're playing into it. And you're buying into these theoretical diagnoses and apply them to everybody. Well, because that's what you went to school for. And if you're a hammer, well, then everything's a fucking nail. You see, I couldn't sleep at night anymore when I was witnessing this. I couldn't take that anymore. For some fucking crazy reason, Joe saw that shit, put it out there, and well, I took a lot of shit for it. I was nervous as fuck. I said some generalizations. I probably sounded, he even mentioned it on the podcast, that I had an urban talk. Well, I'm sorry, man. That's just where the fuck I come from, homie. It's what we went through. You see, I didn't choose to have to turn into a totally different person later in life when I was just trying to change how I was behaving. I don't know why I said it that day. I don't know why I did it, but I knew what I was risking. But people were fucking dying. People were dying and they were coming to these places for help and they were leaving on more drugs, convinced that they were fucked for the rest of their fucking lives. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. So I left it after that fucking push. I started working like a madman. If you've ever seen the movie Beautiful Mind or Good Will Hunting, I felt like Will many times, but sometimes I'd work that board like an algorithm going, there's got to be another fucking way. And so I looked at my own fucking life and the shit that I went through and how I was able to think this. And then I applied all the research knowledge from multiple fields, man. And I said, how can I lay this out? How can I give people a fucking master's degree in mental health counseling to change their own fucking lives without months and years of therapy? And I worked that shit for years. Thanks to a father-like person to me and a mentor, Leo D'Annibale, he changed my life. He changed my life. That mentor changed my fucking life. And I love you for that, Leo. He's in the book multiple times. He helped me work this theory that I was coming with. And every day I had two or three groups a day. I was working these theories in groups. I was passionate about helping people. I was in there. I was diving the fuck in there. There had to be another way. And I ended up coming up with this fancy fucking thing called transrational structure behavior theory, but it was linked to real science. Not to calling yourself powerless or admitting you had some disease. It was backed by research, real science, real shit. Theorists that were before me, that were great minds that put things together, but sometimes were so narrowed on their approach that they couldn't see that other approaches had oomph too. Behavioralists, structuralists, cognitive practitioners, social psychologists. I brought all those together, and that's what ended up being transrational structure behavior theory. I put that book out in 9 months. So if you've read it, then you may know why there's some grammar errors and some things in there that we go, what the fuck and where did he go? That's the truth. I wanted to put it out there so fast. I was like, somebody needs this. So as transrational structure behavior theory became, well, odd, boring, and as we joked about on the podcast with Joe, it turned into the cognitive rampage. And I tell you, podcast remorse exists because I have a lot of remorse from some things I said on that podcast, exclusively when he asked me about cognitive rampage. And I said, when I talk, well, sometimes I get rampagey. It was rather fucking weak when there's a meaning behind that that's much deeper. Well, see, transrational is a word that I made up. To trans is to go beyond, to move through, to transition into. Rational, obviously, is the idea of rationally thinking. So to transition into the rational mind and the rational thinking, rational process is what I meant by it. So transrational structure insists that the idea that if we can structure routine and behaviors, well, then we sometimes are our own rats in a maze. But we can run our own experiments on ourselves. So if we know that we are rats and we operate behaviorally, well, then we can structure our lives through rational thinking to change our behavior. And that led me to transrational structure behavior theory. And behavior is so influential. The behavioralist, the environmentalist, the epigenetic effects, the social influence. These were all ideas that are so important, so imperative. And the more science goes on, the more we realize that the epigenetic may have more of an effect than the actual genetic, that DNA can be changed and modified by the epigenetic and environmental influence. But cognitive theorists tend to ignore that. Some cognitive behavioral theorists embrace that, but there was separation. And we all know if you're the hammer, well, that's a nail. And I thought, how can I bring all of these into one that I've learned about? Because there's greats in all categories, there's positives and all, but we know that we're a full synergy, a full synergistic operating species and being, that we are affected by our environment. We are affected by what we think, by what we believe. We are affected especially by our biology to begin with, which is the baseline to change. Well, hence the cognitive fucking rampage, a dose of authentic revelation, because it's you that's going to reveal an authentic revelation about yourself. And please don't ever tell me that's just who I am, because you never are just who you are. You change day to day to day, but if you concrete yourself enough to believe that, well, that's just who I am, well, that's who you will be. And change, well, will seem impossible. But I like to say, if you're not willing to question the impossible, well, then you're planning for the inevitable. So I had to develop principles, basic foundations. There's tons of theories out there that 50, 60, 70, 100 plus principles. I wanted a few. Because if I was sending you into war, I would say these are your three weapons and this is your mission. And that's how I approach this book, because all of us are on this mission. We are all at war with ourselves until you can find that peace, until you can find that strategy that works for you. So I approach writing this theory, this book, as if I know that you're at war. And I know what your mission is. I know what you seek. So in these principles that I came up with, these concrete principles, if you will. The first principle of change that I began to work on was, well, probably the most powerful. Not probably, is the most powerful. Maybe other than your biology. Is your belief principle. You see, the belief principle references your core beliefs, your concrete beliefs, and whether they're rational or not. See, the core beliefs are very, very, very imperative. Very important. See, your core beliefs are very simple, and they are this. What do you believe about the world? What do you believe about others? And what do you believe about self? You see, most people just respond to how they think they feel. And they don't realize that everything that you believe creates what you think, but I'll get to that second principle soon. The first principle is understanding that what you believe is what it is. And the first thing you have to try to comprehend that there is no truth. That the only truth that is what you believe. Because if you ride a roller coaster and you tell me it's not scary, and I ride it and I tell you, well, it is scary, who's telling the truth? You see, that belief principle from our perception creation based on our experience is what, well, concretes our beliefs. And so your three core beliefs are what you believe about others, the world, and self. So whatever you believe, I don't care if it's I like eggplant or I like the Dodgers, any of those things, none of which I like, any of those things, any belief beyond that or any thought that you have beyond that begins at the core foundation of those three beliefs, what you believe about the world, others, and self. And this is pulling directly from cognitive researchers and theorists such as Albert Ellis and many, many more. Aaron Beck and beyond. Lazarus, I quote them in the second edition. I take you much further into the research in the second edition of where this is and how this is based in science. So these cognitive theorists, these godfathers of the mindfulness, if you will, because all mindfulness really is the cognitive approach. They just found a better way to sell it. So what you believe through those cores are filtered. So if you ask yourself, what do you believe about the world? And give me that in one sentence. What do you believe about others? And give me that in one sentence. What you believe about self? And give me that in one sentence. Is that sentence negative? What is it filtered through? Is it optimistic? Does it push hope? See, if any of those beliefs are corrupt with negative, pessimistic ideas of your truth to be, well, reality, well, then every other perception that stems from those three beliefs, how do you think it's going to be? Positive? Optimistic? So if what you believe about the world, others, and self seems to be rooted in some negative connotation of your experience of world, others, and self, well, then you believe your own truth. And those are the two parts to this belief principle. Your core beliefs, others, self, the world, and your concrete beliefs. Those beliefs that you have now concreted to be truth and reality in your world based on your three core beliefs. So you see how, based on our experience and what we have, we determine what we believe about the world, others, and self. Then when we have those locked down and buried, well, it allows us to process patterns, life, moments much more quickly. So we can take those foundations of the core beliefs, and then any beliefs we lay on top of those, well, they're stemming from those three beliefs. And then you concrete them. And what I mean, obviously, by concrete is a belief that you won't let go of. A belief that you hold to be so true. Why? Because you experienced it. And you'll be damned if somebody would tell you something different. So those core beliefs become concrete, which then sprout and found and seed most of your other beliefs that you believe to be true. But most people don't ask themselves why. Why do I believe that? Or nor are they humble enough to even question their own experience about what happened. You see, questioning what happened in my childhood You couldn't tell me shit. I was fucking there. You couldn't tell me it wasn't that bad or it wasn't this, because this was my truth. But until I realized this was the perception I created, I couldn't begin to understand or fathom how some people from similar or worse environments could excel beyond whatever their expectations were, and why those in the same environment did not. It was their perception, the narrative, the story they told, and how they told it. See, some could use that for motivation to go beyond. Thank God I went through the shit that I went through, because it's allowed me this. See, in that song, Haystack, So What, he references that. That block that made him. Those beats to be him. Grateful for those terrible things that transpired in our lives, and use that as fire and motivation to move forward. Always forward, I say now. So the second principle is the B2B principle. Beliefs to behavior. Pulling again from more cognitive theorists, but now adding the behavioralists. You see, the B2B principle represents that what you believe creates what you think. What you think manifests what you feel. What you feel predicts how you'll behave. But too many times we walk around in this world simply telling ourselves, this is how I feel. I feel like this. We're trained to analyze ourselves in feeling, and we're totally missing the foundation that the feeling is based in the thought. You cannot have a feeling unless you have a thought first. You just choose to ignore the thought because it's rooted in your core concrete beliefs that help you operate through your pattern of thinking so quickly that you don't even realize you're having thoughts before you create your own fucking feeling. But then again, we'd have to be humble enough to question that what we believe really may not be true, and that what we are thinking really is stemming from what we believe to be true. And it takes a humility to question self before we question others in the world. So the B2B principle is stating to you that you have to first affirm to the idea that there is no reality and truth, that yet our perception creates that reality and truth. And when we can grasp and understand that what we believe then manifests our thoughts, and our thoughts are thus created by ourselves. And so what we choose to think about or hold on to think about thus is why you feel the way you feel. But we'd rather say it's you, it's the environment, it's things, it's everything else. This is strong. When you can't change your environment, what I'm saying is you can change your perception of it. But let me tell you that this doesn't last. It can help in the short time. It can bring down the redlining anxieties and depression. But over time, the environment wins. Thank you, Mitch. The environment will win. See, it's a great cognitive tool. That's why I love those theorists like Albert Ellis and those I quoted before. Because it's powerful that we are the superhero to our own thoughts. That yes, you have automatic thoughts, but we can control which ones we hold on to and the ones we allow to blossom within our heads, creating our feelings. And when you realize that you are creating your feelings, well, then you also have to be humble enough to admit that no one makes you mad and no one makes you happy, that no one makes you sad, that it is you. From the beliefs of which your perception of the experience is, creates exactly the thoughts that you want to create, that are creating the feelings you have because you think you should, aka believe you should. So the past experiences of everything else that has told you what you're supposed to feel when this happens is not even you. But these are things that are hard for people to grasp because, well, it's told our story. It's the narrative. It's how we've been telling it to our girlfriends, our ex-girlfriends, our kids, ourselves, our family. We've told this story so many times that we can't dare part with this story because, well, it's who I am. And if we part with that story, well, then we lose who I am. So to even grasp the beginning of the fact that the narrative that you tell is simply based on your perception of the experience, your ride of the roller coaster, well, that's a hard thing to do unless you practice humility. Which takes me to the third principle of change, which is the H equals C principle, that humility equals competence. See, competence is wisdom and knowledge, not experience, but competence comes from experience, but competence comes first. But how can you gain competence if one is not humble enough to admit what you don't know, or at least able to admit that what you experienced is your mere perception? Again, you hold on to the narrative. It takes a practice of humility. Simply saying that you are a humble person, well, is an oxymoron based on what humility even means. So quit saying you're humble and believing you are, because stating that you're a humble person really just states the opposite. That it is truly a practice of humility. There are men that live up in the Tibetan mountains that have been doing it for a lifetime that still haven't narrowed down the full unselfish practice of living and thinking. But you'll do it over in this world full of social constructs being missiled at you like it's no tomorrow. You see, you have to be willing to ask and question your own beliefs, your own experiences, your own perceptions. Not simply say, it's dad's fault. It's the violence fault. It's the environment's fault. Again, mixing the power of the cognitive reframing of the perception, which is powerful to help you change the perception of the environment. But then when you implement this principle of humility and understanding the beliefs, well, then we can understand and give the power to what the environment really gives us and make the change behaviorally. The H equals C principle is the reminder that in the practice of humility, we will gain competence, self-competence. When we get competent in something, then, well, we can be confident in something. Being confident in something does not mean that you only know one side of the story or one party line. Confident means you can have a debate for both sides of the argument. This leads to true confidence. So in self, in order to have true self-confidence that some to allude to as self-esteem, well, we need full self-competence. We got to know both sides of the story. The perception and the narrative we've been telling based on what we're supposed to believe, and the one that we can create at will. And this takes me to the last principle of change, which is the CCE principle that states with competence comes confidence, and through confidence comes enthusiasm. You see, people are on this endless chase to be happy. You see, about the only things our godfathers or forefathers got right was the idea of the pursuit of happiness. Oh, you can pursue it. But remember, happiness is a state of mind. It's not happiness you're after. It's enthusiasm that you're after. Happiness is this gorilla in the mist that you may have seen or may never find. It's a moment of joy that happens that we create based on what we believe, because we create what we think, so we create what we feel. I would ask you now, play an actor, an actress for me in your auditioning. Show me joy right now. Show me joy. What are you thinking? Show me sadness right now. Give me sad. What are you thinking? Do you see how what we think creates the emotion, which then oozes the feeling? But that's hard to face unless you're willing to face the first principles that what we believe is only based on our own perception and we control the master of it. And we are the master of it. And many times people will even sell the idea that change is a process. You have to accept the process. Well, see, I tell you, change can happen now, right now. Because all that change is the process of changing your belief, accepting the idea of everything I've discussed. But the moment change happens is not the process. It's the moment that you actually go, I can question that belief. I can question those irrational, negative, concrete beliefs. Simply because I experienced it doesn't mean it's true. And we can question our core beliefs. What do I believe about the world? Ask yourself. Most people don't even know. They know if they like eggplant or the Dodgers, but most can't tell you. What do you believe about self? What do you believe about the world? And what do you believe about others? And give it to me in one sentence. If what you say after that, well, you're going to know if it sounds negative, especially irrational. I even give you words in the book I call determinant words that are like red flags to let you know what you're thinking is probably irrational. But if we can question at least ourselves, at least know what we believe at our core about others, the world, and self, well, then you can't unlearn what you now know, as Leo used to tell me. And then if we are willing to question those beliefs, well, then we can begin to break up the concrete beliefs that are anchoring us down from any type of mental change in our life. We question those concrete beliefs. Through questioning the concrete beliefs, we can form new ones. Then we can grasp the idea that whatever I believe is creating what I think, and what I think is creating what I feel, and how I feel, well, is going to predict whether I punch you in the fucking mouth or not. You see, if somebody's walking down the road and they bump into your shoulder like you weren't even there, this is stealing from Ellis and the ABCs. The action event there is the man bumping your own shoulder. What happens and precedes any action, whether the world causes it to you or you cause it, thus is the belief, the B. That belief then determines your C, your consequence. So if this man's walking down the road and bangs into your shoulder, action event, your belief is this motherfucker disrespected me. What might you think? And then when you turn around, how might you behave? You follow. But if I'm walking down the road and this man again bumps into my shoulder, activating event, and then I move to be my belief, and maybe the automatic thought does come to knock this motherfucker out. But I catch it and I realize it's irrational, and then I simply reframe and change that belief quickly because I am the superhero to my own beliefs. And I change it, and maybe I say to myself, maybe he's late for a funeral. When I turn around, how might I feel? How might you behave? That is the superpower which you possess in anything that has ever happened to your life. That's why I love my cognitive people. That's why I love my behavioralists at the same time. Because when we change that thought, we can change our behavior. And that's what the B2B principle reminds you. But none of this is possible unless you really understand and practice humility. Because through that humility, we can equal a self-competence that leads to a genuine self-confidence. A genuine self-confidence is not an arrogance. A genuine self-confidence is based in a self-competence because we are self-aware. And through that self-awareness, we become competent about ourselves, which gives us the ability to become competent in other components to change in our lives, our friends, our people, our places, our environments, our jobs, our biology. When we get competent in any of those things, we then can progress toward confidence, a genuine confidence. And in that confidence that you have in any of the topics I discussed, you can then find your enthusiasm. And in that enthusiasm, that is your happiness. Happiness is achievable at any moment you want to without the process, the moment you are willing to question self. You see, I wasn't willing to question self in my narrative for a long time. You see, I had the perfect story to paint why I toted pistols everywhere I went. I still do. You see, I didn't have the humility to even practice the idea that I could be wrong because I was too busy trying to fake it to myself that I had it all together because I was one thread away from not being here anymore. But until I could question all of what I believed about myself, others, and the world, I wasn't changing shit. And then I realized that you and myself, we had the superpower to change those things at any moment. The gifts that we were given. That aha moment. That graceful slap in the face that may make you faithful. Those are the three principles of change. In the Cognitive Rampage, the Transrational Structure Behavior Theory, I ask you as it continues in the book to keep those principles in mind. The next rampage that I do is going to be about phase three, the tools of change. Literal tools-based cognitive, behavioral, structural, and social psychologies. Tools you can apply to yourself through your own belief, through your own self-cultivation, not mine, not telling you this is the way. That would be irrational. So the next Adam's Rampage I do will be on phase three, the tools of change. And I'm going to talk about the first tool of change, which is what I call RSA, or rational self-analysis. And anytime you hear the word rational, expect that it's coming from a cognitive root. And the rest of the rampages I'm going to cover and walk through my book and try to correlate my journal that I kept for 20 years that helped me write this book and tell you a little of my story and tell you some of the clients that I work with and the people that I've helped and people I couldn't help. And maybe try to show you that all of these sciences are powerful and convince you that you are the most powerful. That a spirit resides within you that is stronger than any roar you have ever heard or even heard about. That in a moment, you can change your life. Not a process, but in a fucking moment. The moment you believe it to be so. The moment you can question your own reality and shape a different perception to tell a different story to change your life. That's what I mean when I tell you I hope you're taking care of you. And I hope you live in your cognitive rampage. Love y'all.